Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Paradigm Press YouTube channel. My name is Sean Ring. I'm the editor of The Rood Awakening. And today I have with me my good friend and frequent Rood contributor and also strategic intelligence contributor, Byron King. Byron, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Wonderful to be with you. Hello to everybody out there in viewer land. Hey.
Brilliant. Okay, so we're here in the Watergate Hotel. There's lots to talk about, but I guess we'll kick it off first with energy and oil and, you know, but we've got, you know, since we're surrounded by all that history, let's start out with Tricky Dicky and how we got to this mess, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, we are at the Watergate Hotel of Watergate fame in Washington, D.C. It's 2024, which it just happens to be the 50th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. And that culminated, you know, a year and a half or so, 2 years actually, of, you know, investigations and what have you. And it started here at the Watergate. The Democratic National Committee. Watergate's not just a hotel. It is had office buildings and things like that. The Democratic National Committee had an office here, and apparently some bad people did some bad things, as some congressperson once said. They broke into the DNC to try to, I don't know, steal their secret documents and find out what's their secret strategy to win the election. Well, you know, along the way they got caught, and these guys were just, you know, they were the low level little flunkies. They were the little, you know, they're little screwdriver guys, you know, and the cover up, it's not the crime, it's the cover up, you know. It could be trespassing. It could be some misdemeanor sort of a thing, but the cover up is, you know, kind of where it all filtered up to the White House and Richard Nixon. And, and so, you know, lots of investigations later, you know, it turned out that Nixon had been recording conversations in the Oval Office, which had been happening since the days of at least Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, it's not that he was the first to do it. I mean, as long as they had recording capability, people were recording conversations in the Oval Office. It was a standard thing to do. LBJ had them, JFK had them, Eisenhower, you know. So when they found out that Nixon had these tapes, they subpoenaed the tapes. He fought it in court. The court said, oh, no, they got to turn the tapes over. The tapes had all sorts of, you know, impertinent comments, you know, the things that people say when they don't think anybody's listening. You know? And, you know, kind of like you and me.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. Anyhow, for the good of the nation, you know, the elders of the Republican Party made a big show of walking into the White House and sitting down with Nixon, and then Nixon, I hereby resign the presidency. It was like a one and a half line letter, you know, White House, I hereby resign. Richard Nixon. Yeah, and he got on the helicopter. He went, you know, au revoir, you know, and off into history he went, and Gerald Ford took over. Well, you know, why'd that happen? How'd that happen? I mean, you know, a lot of people didn't like Nixon, that's for sure. You know, they had not, I mean, he served in the Navy in World War II, served very honorably. He was an interesting character in terms of his youth growing up in Southern California. You want somebody who is like from dirt farmer to high office, that's his story. I mean, if you ever get the chance to see the Nixon Library in Los Angeles, or, you know, out in that area, it's definitely worth the tour. They have the house that he grew up in, things like that. It's a fascinating place. So his dirt poor beginnings, you know, led him, you know, to college, into the Navy. After the Navy, he went into politics, among other things. And the first thing he did was he defeated a Democrat. Oh, you know, well, you know, you become a marked man when you defeat a Democrat. And as he was a senator from California, and staunch anti-communist. He went after a guy named Alger Hiss, who had worked at the Roosevelt administration. Alger Hiss was a Soviet spy. Oh, no, he wasn't. Oh, yes, he was. We know, because in the 1990s, the National Security Agency declassified the tapes of Alger Hiss being, you know, handled by his handlers, the Soviets. You know, they hated him for that. You know, they hated him because he was Eisenhower's vice president. You know, they never wanted him to be president in the first place in 1968. Hubert Humphrey was supposed to be president. He won.
It destroyed him.
It was a three-way election. George Wallace ran, won a big whack of the old South, you might say. And Nixon won. You know, he won the elections. Then he wound down the Vietnam War. He didn't just sort of cut and run or walk away. He kept fighting, which cost a lot of lives and cost a lot of money, but it was LBJ's war. LBJ is the one who had, you know, he had fed, you know, 750,000 troops in there, and, you know, billions and billions of dollars, and, you know, the bombers and the bombings and everything else. I'm going to tell you, I seldom tell this story. I actually had dinner one time with Henry Kissinger. I was invited to a private affair dinner with that Henry Kissinger. And I'm just going to say this because we can talk. We're all friends and family here. And I asked Henry Kissinger, I said, Mr. Kissinger, what was it like becoming, you know, national security advisor to Richard Nixon, you know, in January 1969? You come into the White House and, you know, and here's the Vietnam War going. It's one thing to be on the outside as a commentator, as a professor at Harvard, as, you know, I mean, you'd been to Vietnam. But you come in and now it's your baby. You've got to do it. And he looked at me and he said, LDJ, in Vietnam, he handed us a flaming bag of shit with that Vietnam War. We had to deal with it. And so the sense that, you know, when you're an outside commentator just saying, you should do this and you should do that, and you're Monday morning quarterback, that's one thing. When you're the guy who has to make the decisions, you know, we'll put more troops in, do we bomb some more, do we do this, do we do that? We're going to kill our guys, we're going to kill their guys, what are we going to blow up, you know, what's going on? And, you know, and it's a proxy war because we're fighting the Soviet Union. I mean, we've got ships going into Haiphong Harbor, unloading weapons, and can't bomb those ships, and can't mine the harbor and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it was really quite a delicate thing. Nixon dealt with all that. You know, he dealt with, as Henry Kissinger said, the flaming bag of shit that he had been handed by LBJ. And so then he runs for re-election in 1972. This whole Watergate incident happens during the lead up into the campaign and such. It's this nasty little nothing burger sort of in the back during the campaign. Nixon won in a landslide in 72. He beat George McGovern. And George McGovern was, you know, was a classic Democrat liberal. And he was a World War II hero. He was a bomber pilot in the Air Corps, the U.S. Air Force, but the Army Air Corps. Very heroic guy. In many ways, he just had a lot of, you know, kooky ideas about economics. And he admitted that later on in his life. Much later, he admitted, if I'd have known then what I know now, I wouldn't have held some of those ideas. But Nixon crushed him. And so he goes into 1973, the inauguration. You know, by 73, he had wound down the war in Vietnam. But the knives were out for Nixon. They had to get rid of him. One of the things Nixon wanted to do, and this will get us into an investment thesis, because we could talk about this all day, but Nixon had taken the U.S. off the gold standard in 1971. He, in the back of his mind, was planning to sort of get us back on something like the gold standard during the second term. It was kind of like, we did it out of necessity. We had to kind of get inflation under control. That inflation was a legacy of the Vietnam War, all that spending on bombs and bullets and troops overseas and everything else. So Nixon had it in the back of his mind to get back on the gold standard. He never served long enough to do that. Another thing he did, which completely, outraged the bureaucracy of Washington, D.C., was he said that he was going to de-escalate the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. Right. We built up this bureaucracy since the 1930s, certainly in the 40s during World War II, in the 50s and 60s during the Cold War, and the LBJ buildup, and the war on poverty, all these offices and alphabet soup agencies. He was going to scale them back. Well, that doesn't go well in these suburbs that we see out the windows here, over there in Rosslyn and over there in Georgetown and there in Bethesda. It doesn't play well in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. when you do that. And then another thing that Nixon said, and this, who knows, this may have been the nail in the coffin or, the stake in the heart. He said that he actually knew what had happened with JFK.
Yeah.
And, when you talk too loud about that, you really make a lot of enemies. So Nixon left, and Gerald Ford took over. Gerald Ford, who served on the Warren Commission, which had investigated and, whitewashed, you might say, the JFK assassination. He pardoned Nixon. Okay. A whole lot of other people in the Nixon entourage. I mean, dozens of people, the lawyers and assistants of counsels and things like that. They got prosecuted for all sorts of things. I mean, it's a big, long list. And the prosecution machine that they had, the war machine that it really was a Democrat war machine against Nixon and his sort of inner circle. They went after these people for years. Many of them, they spent lots of money. They spent their family fortunes. Some of them went to jail. And so then people were writing books about it. The heroic Watergate, the investigative reporters and Woodward and Bernstein and all that, mean, Bob Woodward, a junior officer in the Navy who gets out of the Navy, goes to work for Washington Post, which has long been known as a as an outlet for the, you know, the CIA. If the CIA wants you to know something, they'll tell it. They'll tell it to the Washington Post. And then Woodward, as a 20-something-year-old guy, high 20s, 27, 28 years old, all of a sudden he starts getting fed this inside dope on the Nixon matter from the number two guy at the FBI.
Yeah, that's right.
How many 27-year-olds do you know, are on the phone or talking or getting, you know, packages from the number two guy at the FBI? Who are you if that happens? You know, you are not just, you know, Joe Blow, the 27-year-old, you know, gumshoe newspaper reporter, you know, some shoe leather reporter out there trying to make a name for yourself. So a long way of saying, describing a lot of history, that the whole Nixon thing was an op. Mm-hmm. They got rid of Nixon. They put him forward. You know, the deep state rolled on. And now they rolled on without a gold standard.
Yeah. Right.
And so that now we had the petrodollar standard, which Henry Kissinger, my dinner companion some years ago. So we came up with the petrodollars, and that was a way of somehow, you know, equilibrating the dollar as the world reserve currency, because everybody uses oil. Everybody buys barrels of oil. And so when the principal producers, Saudi and the rest of OPEC, all say, well, we'll only price oil in dollars. Okay, great. They've just given the U.S. basically blank checks to write, you know, because yep. We can print all the money we want down at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, or create all the money you want down at the Federal Reserve, which is right down there. You could almost see it from the other side of the building here. That's 50 years of history there for you. You
know, yeah, that's amazing.
I didn't mean to take so much time, but you asked the question.
Why'd you have to let you get up?
Yeah, I lived through it. I mean, I can prove it with my driver's license. Yes, I'm that old. You know? I was there. I was young. I was watching it from the outside in, but, you know, I saw it all. So here we are. So gold, energy. What else do we want to talk about?
Why don't we riff off energy? Because we had the OPEC oil crisis pretty much immediately after we got off the gold standard.
And how did that OPEC oil crisis happen? It happened when the Arab countries, Egypt, Syria, invaded Israel.
Yeah.
Oh, there was a war in the Middle East. Gee, that sounds familiar. Wait a minute. A war in the Middle East with Israel getting attacked. Okay. And so Henry Kissinger, again, he went over there and he shuttled diplomacy to everything. He got everything. The Nixon, you know, made a massive airlift to Israel. I mean, just C-5s and C-141s, just full of stuff, you know, just that they needed to fight the war. They were going to lose. Nixon, you know, gave them the ammo literally in a matter of days. I mean, the jets were flying. And they prevailed. They prevailed in the war, in the 73 war. But because the U.S. leaned so hard in Israel's favor, OPEC, you know, embargoed oil to the United States. Well, they didn't stop producing oil and selling it. They just stopped selling it to the U.S.,
yeah.
Which means that the tankers that would have gone to the U.S. went someplace else, but the tankers would have gone someplace else. They could go to the U.S. It was really just a question of, you know, two ships passing in the night.
Right.
Full of oil. Well, I know. Along comes Kissinger. He works out the OPEC, the petrodollar situation, which has prevailed for, you know, let's say 50 years. Okay, great. Good for us, you know. It's breaking down now.
Yep.
You know, with the BRICS. I mean, who are BRICS, which began as a marketing gimmick for Goldman Sachs, but you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. But now, you know, BRICS includes Saudi Arabia. It includes Iran, two big oil producers. Iraq has an application. You know, big oil producer. UAE, big oil producer. Yeah. So I call it BRICS OPEC anymore. So the day that they really go off the dollar standard, they still sell oil for dollars.
Yeah,
of course they do. Yeah, but now they're selling oil for Chinese yuan. They're selling oil for certain local currencies. It's a bilateral thing between different countries. It disfavors the dollar,
you know? Right?
And so, in that sense, you know, as people don't need dollars overseas, the dollars tend to come back home, and they are a source of inflation here at home. You know, people say, "What am I going to do with all these dollars?" Oh, I know. I'll buy some real estate, or I'll buy assets, or I'll buy stocks and bonds. It helps to, you know, lift the asset bubble. Now you might think, well, gee, that's great. I like it when my house goes up in value. Yeah, you do, except that when you sell your house, where are you going to go? Because the house down the way that you wanted to buy to move into, that went up in value too. So
yeah,
you're trading one expensive house to try to buy another expensive house. Or, you know, you're going to sell your stocks, pay your capital gains. And, you know, when it comes with inflation and everything, you know, how much did you really make? Like our 40,000 point Dow. If you account for inflation of the last, say, 3 years, with a certain group in office, 3 years of inflation, that 40,000 Dow is a 32,000 Dow, you know, in terms of what's it worth, you know, 3 years ago, 32,000. So anyhow, What's going on with energy? The price of oil is supply demand. It's, there is a global recession going on. It's a quiet recession. It's being masked by massive government spending all over the place, USA, China, Russia, and its war spending. I mean, there's an economic boom in Russia right now. I mean, they need young guys to work in their factories. And, you know, you cannot be unemployed in Russia today. Why? Well, because, you know, their economy is booming. Why is their economy booming? Well, because they're fighting a war, you know? And so you've got guys at the front. You've got people working in the factories. Everybody's got a job. But same thing in the U.S. Oh, our GDP looks great and everything. Well, yeah, it looks great when you're spending $1 trillion every 100 days that you don't have. And so what does this mean energy-wise? Long-term energy, go for it. The Green New Scam is a Green New Scam. Don't worry about it. When I say don't worry about it, you know, profit from it. We will be, you out there, we're going to be using oil, natural gas for decades to come, centuries to come. We won't be there to do it, you know, but we won't live long enough to see when people don't use oil and gas.
Right.
Natural gas. You know, big companies, ExxonMobil, Chevron, things. You know, yeah, sure. All those guys. One sector that's really, really, really beaten down, although it's had a stealth recovery, is the offshore oil sector. I've written about it in a Lifetime Income Report. You'll probably see it in The Rude Awakening. But it has to do with drilling offshore on the Outer Continental Shelf. Now, that's a global thing. It's not just the U.S. Gulf of Mexico. It's Europe and the North Sea. It's offshore Mexico. It's offshore South America, Brazil, offshore Africa, the Far East. It's everywhere. Now, the Biden administration is immensely anti, you know, offshore. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have done everything they can not to lease, not to grant permits. The only things they want to build offshore are these big, huge windmills, which create this low-frequency noise that kills the whales. Literally, yeah. Seriously, I mean it. The womp, 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 womp of these windmill blades going around sends these what's called infrasound waves through the water, and it really messes up the whales' navigation system, and they wind up beaching themselves, so they go crazy with it. It's sort of a tinnitus for whales, but it's caused by those offshore windmills. I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. The biologists tell me this. And so, but anyway, that's what the Biden administration like. They don't want, you know, offshore drilling ships out there, you know, poking holes in, you know, a mile under the water and all that. I've been on offshore drill ships. I've got 10 on the platforms. I write about it in this article that you either saw or you will see up there. Some of the offshore plays have had really nice recoveries so far, but it's the beginning of a recovery. You know, you missed the first couple innings of the game, but there's still, you know, more innings to come. You know, there's still, you know, we're not even at halftime of the football game to mix my baseball and football analogies. You know, I'll just throw a few out there. Companies like, you know, Transocean, Rig, RIG, you know, they own drill ships. Well, and in a world where a drill ship is, you know, $1 billion capital investment, you don't just go out and buy one at the used drill ship lot or something. No, they own drill ships. They have them. And so when the offshore sector recovers, and it's already started to recover overseas, call it a play on perhaps a Trump win. You know, Trump comes in and he opens up offshore drilling. Companies like Transocean are going to do really well just on the momentum of, you know, the political win. Diamond Offshore, Noble Energy, you know, drillers like that. Some of the offshore companies that work offshore, Oceaneering International, Oceaneering, wonderful company, just incredible company for services for the whales. Everything from prospecting the seabed to, you know, building the platforms or anchoring the platforms, and, you know, inspecting them once they're there, all the way, cradle to grave, all the way to decommissioning them, you know, 15, 20, 25 years from now when they have to, you know, take the steel and the pipe out and everything. FTI, I think, is the ticker. You know, great companies that work offshore. So, anyhow, there's just a couple things. Energy is solid. Don't worry about it. I mean, if there's a recession, sure, price of oil goes down. Once the recession passes, the world is using oil, and it will only use more oil. And it's going to get a lot of that oil from offshore. And I think offshore is an underappreciated play right now.
Okay, so we like offshore stuff. If we can turn our attention to rare earths, you just wrote a great piece of the Rude for rare earths. For those who haven't read it yet, why don't you just explain all the great stuff?
Okay, rare earths. I mean, okay, guys, back to chemistry class in high school, you know, and you looked at the periodic chart on the blackboard or hanging on the wall, and all those, you know, names of the elements and atomic numbers and all these little numbers and stuff. And like, oh, golly, what's that stuff mean? Down at the bottom were these little things that didn't seem to fit into the chart. Well, they do, but the chart's not big enough, so they put them on the bottom. But, you know, the lanthanides and the actinides, you know, the lanthanides are the rare earths the actinides or the radioactive stuff. But there's always some smart kid in the class who would say, where are those guys at the bottom? And the teacher would say, nah, don't worry about it. They're not on the test. Okay, I'm just telling you right now, they're on the test, okay? They are on the test. I mean, we are recording in front of a, you know, a camera. That camera wouldn't work without rare earths. Your cell phone wouldn't work without rare earths. The light bulbs above our heads are, you know, have rare earths in them. Your car has rare earths if it's a gasoline car. I mean, you've got rare earths in the magnets that control things like, you know, opening and closing the windows. You know, electric vehicle, hello, traction motors, batteries, rare earths. You know, you know, the airplanes that are flying out there up out of the Reagan National Airport, you know, rare earths. No rare earths, your life becomes primitive in a hurry. Well, who runs the rare earth supply of the world? Gee, that would be China, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, 15 years ago, China ran about 95% of the global rare earth supply. Today, after much, much effort and investment and billions of dollars of, you know, marketing and promo, that's down to around, oh, China runs, oh, maybe 84%, 83%, you know. It's not that the rare earths aren't out there. I mean, you know, there are deposits in the U.S., Canada, South America, Africa. There's lots of deposits. So the Chinese have really, you know, they have really made a national effort, literally a national level effort, controlled by their Ministry of Commerce, with, you know, handholding with their Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Intelligence. They have made a full court press to lock up supplies around the world, mineral sands, ore deposits, what have you. And then they've made the investment in processing the materials. It's not an easy chemical process, but it involves, you know, it involves knowing what you're doing. But it's nothing that we can't do in the United States either. But we just don't do it because, in some respects, it's easier to print dollars and buy them from China than it is to actually, you know, set up a plant and actually make them.
Right.
Part of the Infrastructure Act and the Inflation Reduction Act of the last couple of years. This minute, we want to get, you know, a rare earth industry in the West and certainly in the United States. Out in Utah, there's a company I mentioned, Energy Fuels, mm-hmm. in Blanding, Utah. Like in Utah, it's in sort of southeast part of the state, Blanding, little tiny little town, cute little town. Energy Fuels, UUUU. Now, as you might gather from the ticker, they are a uranium company,
right?
But when you the same ore that you get uranium from, they get vanadium, which is another. That's an alloying agent for steel. And then many of the same minerals that have radioactive issues in them, you know, uranium, thorium, also carry rare earths. So they are just standing up and debugging a rare earth circuit at the Energy Fuels. So a great company. I visited the site, whatever. Another play that I've liked for a long time, but they really are kicking into high gear now. It's called UCORE, U-C-O-R-E, but it's U-U-R-A-F, I believe is the ticker. I have visited their pilot plant in Kingston, Ontario. It's north east of Toronto, about 130 miles or something, right on the lake. They've had immense cooperation from the government of Canada, the province of Ontario. That's where they basically really pioneered the technology. But they're building a plant right now in Alexandria, Louisiana. And you say, well, why are they building it in Alexandria, Louisiana? They're building it on the site of the old England Air Force Base, which has these big long runways so you can fly stuff in from around the world. It's not too far from Mississippi, which means you can haul in cargo right next to the railroads and you can bring stuff in by rail, right next to the interstate highway. So, yeah. So, you know, it's location, location, location. And they're building a facility there to process rare earth. So those are two sort of ideas that, in the rare earth side of things. So no rare earths in your modern world goes back 150 years or something.
Yeah. Right. So we absolutely need them. But we've also, you know, we've been talking about inflation. We've gone through energy and rare earths. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention gold.
Gold. Yes. What can you say? I mean, it was, you know, when Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971, it was, you know, $32 an ounce. And then not long after Nixon resigned, and this it had nothing to do with the resignation. It just had something to do with the politics of it. In late 1974, I believe, after Nixon mm-hmm. resigned, Congress passed a bill that made it legal for Americans to own gold. Now, it had been illegal for Americans to own gold since 1933. So, yep. Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order that basically called in the gold. He did it. His legal authority for doing it was, I believe, the Espionage Act of 1917. So he's using this sort of anti-spy act to call in the gold. But all the people dutifully turned in their gold coins and what have you. Some people didn't. They kept them in the basement or buried them in the backyard, whatever. Those coins all went to the U.S. Treasury Department. They melted them down into these big, like 400-ounce bars, in a very, very short amount of time, they built Fort Knox in Fort Knox, Kentucky, at the gold depository. They built the gold depository at Fort Knox, we want to say. And allegedly, that gold is still there, although there are very, very, very few photos of the inside, and no, Goldfinger was not filmed on scene. You know, it wasn't filmed inside the building. No. Okay.
Great movie.
Yeah, great movie. You know, great movie. But it hasn't been audited. I mean, we really don't know what's there. I'd like to believe the U.S. Treasury is not just lying through its teeth at us. We have this many ounces in Fort Knox. The U.S. does not pay too much homage to gold. I mean,
that's right.
We produce a lot of gold in the United States. Nevada has been a mecca for gold mining for decades. You know, I mean, other places in the, you know, Alaska, you know, gold mining. But in terms of, like, how much gold does the U.S. government buy? Not that much. I mean, the gold that it does buy, it buys to supply to the West Point Mint. West Point as in, like, Army, you know, West Point in New York, up the Hudson Valley there. There's a mint there. And you think, well, West Point, that's where the Army football team is. Yeah, they're there. But right down the road is the West Point Mint. And it has big vaults full of, you know, gold raw material. And then they produce gold coins that you can buy on eBay or at your coin shop or what have you, you know, the U.S. Gold Eagles and things like that. So that's the only gold that the government buys. The U.S. government does not buy gold to put into Fort Knox, to restock Fort Knox or to stock it up even higher. Unlike Russia, China, numerous other countries, yeah, world, you know, Turkey, Egypt, lots of, you know, the stands, I mean, India, South African countries, you know, Southern African countries. I mean, they are buying gold for their own national treasury, for their own national account, because they, you know, prudent central bankers anticipate that someday there will be a problem with using dollars, and whatever comes out on the other side of it, we don't know. What we're going to be using as currency to trade globally with, we don't know what's going to happen if there is a dollar problem. But one thing that you can pretty much bet the ranch on, and they are, is that somewhere in the equation is going to be, how many ounces of gold do you have? How many pounds of gold do you have? Probably 8 months ago, gold was around $1,800 an ounce. Not too long ago, gold was around $2,400, you know. And so that's a big move in 7-8 months here, you know. And is it going to go higher? Probably, yeah. I think, early this year, I think we were both talking that, we'll likely see $2,500 gold before the end of the year.
Yeah.
We might see it way before the end of the year.
Any day now.
any day now. And then companion with gold is silver.
Yeah.
I mean, look at silver. I mean, silver was 18, 19, 20 bucks an ounce. It was in the low teens, mid-teens for, years in the last decade there. But now, I mean, it's being bit up. I mean, in China, the physical side gets bit up every night. And then, you know, when the sun goes down in China and the sun rises in the West, you know, the bankers, they knock that price down for paper gold. The Chinese, they're buying paper, or they're buying real gold, real silver at their exchanges. And they actually put it in their pocket and they take it home. You know, that they buy a couple of grams or whatever, few ounces, you know, silver coins, gold coin, whatever. They take it home, they put it in their little, security box. In the West, very, very few people, own physical gold. I mean, we at Paradigm, a lot of us own some element of gold or silver. I mean, we talk about it all the time. And a lot of our readers, viewers out there in viewer land, maybe you own gold, silver. Okay, great. But if you go up and down your street, if you drive up and down your street for, 1,000 yards one way or the other, yeah, and you look at all those houses or all those apartments or all those with, how many of those people do you think own even one gold coin? Own even, maybe they have a little silver dollar that their granddad gave them when they graduated from Boy Scouts or something. I don't know. Yeah. It's not part of the culture in the U.S., but it was part of the economy for centuries. I mean, gold was the backbone of the American economy until 1933. Silver coinage was key to the U.S. economy till the 1960s when LBJ, a dumpster fire Johnson, when he pulled the silver out of circulation. Well, he did it because the inflation was such that the silver in a quarter was worth more than the 25 cents value of the quarter. So we've covered Watergate, we covered Kissinger, Nixon, we covered rare earth energy, rare earth gold, Russia, Ukraine. Last thing, Russia, Ukraine. We're over 2 years into the war. Russia was supposed to lose long ago, but they didn't. Ukraine was supposed to lose long ago, but they didn't. In a sense, you've got two Russian armies fighting each other. You've got the real Russian army, and you've got the Ukrainian army, which was trained by the Russians. And in so many cultural ways, Ukraine is Russia, call it Russia Light, Russia Prime, Russia whatever. Two Slavic Christian nations going at it head to head. It has been a bloody, horrible war. I mean, I'm not telling anybody anything they don't know. But the tragedy of the whole thing is that the war is going to come to an end. No war goes on forever. It's going to end. Mm-hmm. And then people are going to look back and they're going to say, how'd that war start? Why'd that war start? Could we have stopped it? It's kind of like how we do with Vietnam. Why didn't we go to Vietnam? Well, it was Eisenhower. Well, it was Kennedy. Well, yeah, but Johnson was the guy that loaded up the troops on the troop ships. And he's the guy that, authorized the bombings and, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and all that. Yeah. I mean, when you start to dissect what happened to that war, I think a lot of people in the U.S. intelligence community, right up the river there, places like Georgetown, places like State Department right over there, a lot of those people, Defense Department right down there, a lot of those people are going to have a lot of egg on their face, That's putting it really nice. I mean, another way of saying it is that, we have some war criminals collecting government paychecks here in the U.S. And look how the International Criminal Court just indicted, Netanyahu and Gallant over in Israel. And they indicted Hamas as well. Yeah, they're nicely balanced. We'll indict Hamas and we'll indict Israel. Okay, yeah. I mean, I don't want to use them as the model of how to do it. But I think quite a few Americans who have their fingerprints on the Ukraine war, from 2014 and before, all through the lead up, the 8 years from 2014 to 22 when it started, a lot of American diplomatic and military and intelligence fingerprints on a lot of things that happened there. And it led to the war. There, the stories that you hear about how, a month and a half into the war, there was a deal in Turkey to bring the war to a conclusion. We'll make a new line on the map. We'll pull our guys back and pull your guys back. We'll call it even. Somehow or another that got, cut off by the, powers that be that didn't want it to happen. There's a lot of people in Britain and the UK who, they should not take any international airline flights, because they might land somewhere and, you're being met with a, with a summons or a warrant. How's it going to happen? The war's going to end. I think the war's going to end fairly soon. The Ukrainian side has basically run out of troops. They're drafting everybody they can draft. They're drafting 65-year-old guys and 17-year-old kids. And they're out of bullets. They're out of artillery ammunition. They pulled all the M1 tanks back. They had 31 of them. They've lost 8 of them. I mean, the Russians have taken the destroyed M1 tanks, and they've got them on display in Moscow, in Victory Park, just all the destroyed capture equipment. From the war, Russia has tested all of its weapons, all of its electronic warfare, all its missiles, all its doctrine. They've cycled hundreds and hundreds of thousands of troops through combat. They figured out who are the officers who know what they're doing. Who are the ones that are dummies? We got rid of them. The generals have figured out, who are the good generals, who are the dumb generals. Got rid of them. The Ukraine war, the special military operation, whatever you want to call it, that has created a very, very powerful Russia that has a full wartime economy going. They're cranking out the ammunition, cranking out the vehicles, cranking out the jets, the cruise missiles, the you name it. And here in the U.S., on our side, our ability to produce ammunition and such is not able to match that. That's for sure not. And here's a takeaway point on all this that military power is the first derivative of energy and industrial power. If you have energy and if you have a vast industry, you can produce a military. That's what the U.S. had in World War II. Yep. We had energy. We had an unused industrial plant. We could produce all the steel we want, produce thousands of, tens of thousands of ships, hundreds of thousands of airplanes, millions of combat vehicles, billions and billions of rounds of ammunition. We had facilities to train, you know, 12 million people in uniform and, you know, millions others in factory work and in other things to support the war. You know, the U.S. had all of that in the 1940s. We don't have that today.
No.
You know, physically, we don't have the mines, the mills, the factories. We don't have the skill sets, you know, the tool and die makers. We don't have the designers. In another article that I wrote in for The Rude a couple of weeks ago, when I visited the battleship Missouri.
Yes.
New Jersey.
Oh, my God. Oh, listen, New Jersey. Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
I visited the battleship New Jersey in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Navy Yard in dry dock. You know, it's a museum ship moored at Camden.
Yeah, that was a great piece too.
And you know, it's about, you know, 2-3 weeks ago. I don't know, but if we can, it'll put it in the,
we'll put it in the description.
So it's been moored at Camden, New Jersey for 25 years or something like that. And, you know, the crud grows on the hull and things like that. You know, the ship has corrosion issues. They towed it down to dry dock number 3 at the Philadelphia Navy Yard, which was the dry dock where the ship was actually built. You know, so it's like, it's truly homecoming. Mm-hmm. You know, they put the New Jersey in there. They drain all the water. They get under the ship. You know, it's sitting up on these big, huge concrete blocks. I've got photos in my in the article if you haven't read it. And they power cleaned that baby. They took all the crud off. They took the paint off out of the steel. Then they surveyed the steel to make sure the corrosion wasn't too bad. They'd fix what was any, if there's any problems, any potential leaks, you know, new caulking, new, if this rivet rusted, they put a, you know, they welded it over all this. And they're repainting it and it looks gorgeous. That's the story of American industrial power in that era. The keel, well, the ship was authorized in 1939 before the U.S. came in the war. The keel was laid in 1940, and they constructed, you know, the shell of the ship and everything, and they launched it on a December 7th, 1942,
well,
one year after Pearl Harbor. Yeah. And this was the biggest, most powerful battleship the U.S. ever built. And when I say the biggest, that is actually a true statement. I've got to get this in. You know, because we built 6 of them of this class. Only 4 of them ever really cut water and sailed the seas. The other 2 got sort of laid up because the war ended. But we built 4 of them. The New Jersey is 4 inches longer than its 3 sister ships. And so it is the longest battleship ever built. And so why is it 4 inches longer? Because at the Philadelphia Navy Yard where they were building it, a lot of the workers were from New Jersey. And they knew that they were building a ship that was the namesake of their state. So every time they could get away with it, they would cinch something a little bit, a quarter of an inch here, an eighth of an inch there. They'd put a little more weld here, you know, that, you know, instead of, you know, butting the steel together, they'd put it a little further apart and weld the difference in. So at the end, when they launched the ship and the surveyors went out, they said, well, yeah, this ship's 4 inches longer than it should be. And it's go, yeah, because that's in New Jersey. That's our ship, you know. So that's a very New Jersey thing. But the United States had that ability then. In so many ways, we don't have the capability now. Yeah, we produce great systems. We have really smart people. We have really powerful weapons. You know, it's a very thin industrial base that supports it all. And much of that industrial base, a scary amount of that industrial base, relies on foreign components. That's right. Down to the rare earths, you know, down to, you know, the magnets that go into the drive motors and the magnets that go into, or, you know, the electronics, the rare earths and the electronics, things like that. Russia's right out there now at the cusp. You know, we are way, way, way behind the USA is. So something to take away, you know, from an investment angle, yeah, you know, you're investing in the military industrial complex. Those guys are in business forever. They're going to be making money for a long time to come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't go wrong with the American defense industry right now. Byron King, thank you so much for joining us once again, and all your contributions.
What a pleasure.
Everyone, read Byron's articles of Lifetime Income Report, Strategic Intelligence, and The Rude. And I'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us.